This is the Everything Financial Radio program. I am your host, Dennis Tubergen. Thanks for tuning in today. Joining me on today's program is the author of The Fourth Turning and Generations, Mr. Neil Howe. We'll get Neil's take on actually what the parallels are between today and the decade of the 1930s, economically speaking. Some of the parallels that we'll talk to him about are interesting and striking. You certainly won't want to miss that. I'll today be talking about fiat currencies. Winston Churchill said the best way to see into the future is to study the past. I certainly believe that is the case, and we'll be taking a look at a number of different fiat currencies, and interestingly, the outcome is always the same. So you'll want to pay attention to that. And most importantly, we'll be talking about some things you might do to get ready for what we believe is inevitable. I want to remind you that we do have a free resource available to you every week. It is the Portfolio Watch newsletter. If you're not yet a subscriber, the Portfolio Watch newsletter is delivered via email every Monday. If you'd like to get a free subscription, all you have to do is visit the website, yourretirementoutlook.com. The website is yourretirementoutlook.com. That's Y-O-U-R, retirementoutlook.com. Just enter your name and email address, and we'll be very, very glad to get you your free copy of the newsletter. Also, coming soon is a revision of the new retirement rules book. Stay tuned, and we'll tell you how to get that as well. I'm pleased to have back on the Everything Financial radio program a guest I had on a little over a year ago. His name is David Skarica. David is the founder and editor of Addicted to Profits. It's a popular newsletter known for its stellar performance in both up and down markets. Mr. Skarica entered the financial markets at a very young age, and at the age of 18 became the youngest person on record to pass the Canadian Securities Course. He's a regular speaker at trade and investment conferences, and he's a guest on the Business News Network, which is Canada's flagship business broadcasting network. You may have also seen David's work in publications such as the Bull and Bear Market Financial Report, Barron's Investor's Digest of Canada, and Canadian Money Saver. Mr. Skarica also writes Gold Stock Advisor, an investment newsletter for the conservative media outlet Newsmax. David, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
David, let me just start, because we were chatting a bit before we actually started to record our conversation, about some of the parallels that you're seeing now in the stock market versus 2007. And we all know that 2007, really toward the end of that year, is when the big decline started. Can you maybe enlighten the listeners?
Well, see, what's interesting about markets is they all kind of top the same way. There's a very kind of textbook top, and it may not exactly be the same, because basically what happened this time around is we had this six-month trading range, and then we dumped in August, and in 2007 we'd have that kind of top. But essentially what happens is usually you get a 10 to 15% correction. That happened actually in each case in August. Happened in August of this year and August of 2007. And then you'll get a rally that can either maybe only take 50 or 60% of those losses back, or maybe even go close to the new highs. But what usually happens is most stocks are acting very, very poorly on that rally, not participating in it. And then maybe you get a few kind of mega, macro cap stocks, like these big tech stocks, et cetera, that really outperform, because everyone, I guess, especially with there being more and more computer trading all the time, all of the algo robots kind of all go into those stocks because they're the last things acting well. And that drives up the market averages, but it masks the weakness in the entire market. Like, I became bearish on the markets in about early to mid-2014, and last year was a very difficult year to short. Most things were still going higher. Most things were acting well outside of a few sectors and a few stocks. But this year, I've had great success shorting. I've noticed most of the stocks I'm short are acting very poorly, are going down, et cetera. And shorting is basically selling the stock before you own it to basically bet that it will go down in price. So the way you make money shorting is as company ABC is 10, it goes down to 6, you sell it at 10, you buy it back at 6, and you net that 4 points in the middle. So that's what shorting is. And essentially, I've noticed this year, most stocks are not acting well. We've got the Googles and Amazons and Apples and Netflixes of the world, going up to new highs and going straight higher. But this is masking the weakness in the entire market. And why that's important is that happened in 1989, before the market topped, and only like a few tech stocks and dot-coms and stuff were going higher. And that also happened in 2007 when most stocks went lower. And actually, very similar to 2007, in that October quarter, in that month, back then, Google, Amazon, Microsoft, BlackBerry, which was a tech leader back then, Apple, they all gapped up in their earnings and basically peaked in the fourth quarter. Well, this time around, we saw Amazon, Apple, Google, all the same thing, they gap up and rally recently in recent weeks and go to new highs. Well, the rest of the market is really acting poorly. And again, like 2007 in October, the market rallied back to its summer high and then turned over. And in 2000, the market rallied back to its March high in August and then rolled over. And this time around, we've rallied back, you know, to within a percent or two of the summer high, but with very terrible breadth and leadership, and we're starting to roll over. And another important thing I'm seeing right now is a lot of these interest rate sensitive sectors, like the tobacco stocks, which, you know, people were piling into because there's no yield in government bonds, or REITs, or a few other things, or even some of these other momentum names, I've noticed have actually started to show weakness in the last, in November. So I think that's also important because we're losing even more leadership. And I think this bodes very poorly for the first half of 2016 going into the latter part of 2016. And I think the reason most people don't feel it is most people maybe own an index fund, like, you know, through maybe the spiders, or they own one of these big tech stocks. Because Apple, for example, is like maybe the most owned stock I've ever seen, even more than Microsoft back in the late 90s. So if you own these stocks, yeah, they're all up, you know, year to date. The market's up a few percent year to date. Apple is up, I think, even with the recent decline, it's up about 10% year to date. And, you know, like Amazon is up over 100% year to date. So these are widely held stocks, so people maybe aren't feeling it, but you can see the poor action in the majority of stocks. And it would be even poorer without all of the financial engineering. Companies basically taking advantage of cheap money to buy back their stock to hide the fact that their earnings and revenue growth are extremely weak. The only reason that companies are seeing flat earnings, because revenues are actually falling 5 to 10% year over year for a lot of these companies, is they're buying back stock, reducing the amount of stock outstanding. That may sound fine, but when you're essentially borrowing money and destroying your company's balance sheet to do that, to meet your quarter-to-quarter earnings, this is going to have serious implications. Now, in the last financial crisis, the crisis was, you know, in the banking sector. I think this crisis is going to see a crisis in corporate debt, because these companies now have twice as much debt on their books as they did back in 2008, and they're seeing deteriorating fundamentals. And at some point, you're going to have to roll over that debt. And it's saying in 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, you've got to roll over that debt. And corporate rates are double what they are now. These companies will be in really real, real problems. I tell people it's almost like a fake market, because you're essentially supporting your stock price by buying back stock at multi-year highs and doing it by borrowing money. And I think this will have serious consequences down the line. And by the way, these are the kind of companies I'm personally shorting. I'm looking for companies with weak balance sheets or that are overhyped and who I think can really, really fall heavily. And I usually stay away from shorting those big, well-known names, because they're kind of like story stocks and people love their Tesla cars or Netflix or whatever. And even though actually I do have a small short on both of those, I really go into these kind of second tier names that don't have maybe this cult following and can fall a lot faster.
Well, we're chatting today with Mr. David Skorica. David's newsletter is Addicted to Profits. If you'd like to learn more about his work, you can go to addictedtoprofits.net. You said something about breadth. Market breadth. So maybe define that and then compare breadth in a healthy market versus the breadth we're seeing in the market today.
Well, like breadth in a healthy market is, I'll give you a perfect example, is that there's a quick little indicator I watch. I look at the stocks trading over their 200-day moving average. So, you know, it's simply like, you know, every stock, you, in technical terms, you have the 200-day moving average, which is the average 200-day price of the stock, right? So the average price of it over the 200-day, and that kind of smooths out the price action of the stock. And if we go look at this indicator right now, what you're seeing is only less than 60% of stocks are above the 200-day moving average. Now, when the market was rallying all through 2013 and 2014, this would usually be at 80 to 90%. And actually, this got down to 20, 30% at the market's lows back in August and September. So this means that we're basically 20 to 25 percentage points lower than where we should be. And it means that actually on the S&P 500, just over half the companies are over the 200-day moving average. And if you're looking at an index that is just a few percent from its highs, this should be much, much higher, okay? This should be this should be 70 to 80 to 90%, you know, like it was in 2013, 2014. And that's just one example. And just so you know, that has actually been trending down since the middle of 2014. So, and then the advanced decline volume, so the amount of volume going into the advancing stock, that again has been decreasing for, you know, very rapidly since the spring. So these are types of things that are telling me that the majority of stocks are not participating in this rally. Just so you know, the advanced decline volume is nearly 15% lower than it was at the top of the market in May. So again, this just tells me that there's not a lot of oomph in this into the upside. And by the way, the inflows show this. Actually, a lot of money is not inflowing to stocks. Again, to get back to my point earlier, the largest inflow of money into stocks is companies buying back their own stock. Actually, ETFs and mutual funds are seeing very minimal inflows into their stock prices. And actually, the last comment I'll make is another internal deterioration is yesterday on the S&P 500, there were 13 new highs on the S&P 500. And at the peak of this rally, or essentially yesterday, but in November, mid-November, there was about 13 new highs. At the peak of this rally in October, there was about 60, 70 new highs. During the rally all throughout 2013, 2014, there would be days where there's 100, 150 new highs in the S&P. Again, showing only a small number of stocks are participating in the rally.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there for this segment. Our guest today again is Mr. David Skorica. His newsletter is Addicted to Profits. We'll continue our conversation with David when Everything Financial Radio returns. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I am your host, Dennis Tubergen. Glad you decided to tune in today. And thanks to our special guest, author Neil Howell, for joining us today. In fact, we'll be continuing our conversation with Mr. Howell in the next segment. Winston Churchill said, "The best way to see into the future is to study the past." Well, that's very, very true. And I want to use that particular quote today. I want to focus on that quote to talk to you about money and currency, and in particular, fiat currencies. You know, those of you that have listened to the Everything Financial Radio program for any period of time, or maybe have read the New Retirement Rules book, or have attended a New Retirement Rules class, know that we talk about something called the money currency cycle. And the money currency cycle has a very simple premise, and it simply is that over time, money and currency change. Currency evolves. The first step in the money currency cycle is that currency and money are the same thing. Some of you may remember pre-1965 when U.S. silver coins were actually made from silver. In fact, if you had $100 in silver coinage, whether that was 100 silver dollars or 200 half dollars or 400 quarters, you had 72 ounces of silver. The money had intrinsic value, and that's really the definition of money. Money is something that has intrinsic value, and it's a good store of value over a period of time. At that same time, currency also circulated. Currency would have been a silver certificate at the time. Some of you may still have a silver certificate in your possession. The only reason you would really have one today is that this silver certificate has some collector value. If you had a $10 silver certificate, which said on the bottom, across the bottom of this piece of paper, across the bottom of this receipt, payable to the bearer on demand. What did that mean? Well, if you had a $10 silver certificate, if you had a $10 receipt, if you had this piece of paper that didn't really have any intrinsic value, you could take it to the bank and exchange it for the money. You could exchange it for the real money that had intrinsic or tangible value. So while that $10 silver certificate didn't have $10 worth of value, you could go exchange it for coins and 7.2 ounces of silver. Then as time goes on, this link between currency and money, this link between paper and the real money, actually is eliminated. That allows politicians and policymakers who, historically speaking, politicians and policymakers collectively as a group, I'm not picking on any particular politician today, although since we're in an election season, that might be pretty easy to do, but I will refrain. You find that they tend to overspend, and when they do overspend, they eliminate this link between paper, the receipt, and the real money, and they create something called a fiat currency, which is currency by decree. Typically, it's paper that doesn't have a direct link to money. It doesn't have a direct link to something tangible. It's not exchangeable at a fixed rate to something tangible. It's simply money or currency and has value and can be used because the government says that it's currency. Now, there was an article published on the Daily Reckoning, which I thought was very instructive. And it was titled, Fiat Currency, Using the Past to See into the Future. That sounds a lot like that Winston Churchill quote we just talked about. I want to give you just a bit from that article. The history of fiat money, to put it kindly, has been one of failure. In fact, every fiat currency since the Romans first began the practice in the first century has ended in devaluation and eventual collapse. Not only of the currency, but of the economy that housed the fiat currency as well. The author asks, why would it be different here in the U.S.? And then he answers his own question. Well, in actuality, it hasn't been. In fact, in our short history, we've already had several failed attempts at using paper currency. And it is my opinion that today's dollars are no different than the Continentals issued during the Revolutionary War. Now, if you're not familiar with the Continentals, after the Revolutionary War, the Continental Congress actually issued $2 million in paper notes. Now, $2 million in the late 1700s was a lot different in terms of valuation and purchasing power than today, but yet this sudden infusion of paper currency with no backing, they were backed only by a promise to pay the holder of these notes back out of future tax revenues. That's exactly what essentially every currency in the world today is a credit note. That created massive inflation, and they eventually ended up having little value. In fact, they had no value. In fact, George Washington, the first president of the United States, said of the Continentals that it took a wagon load of currency to buy a wagon load of provisions. So that fiat currency actually failed, and that was a currency failure that happened here in the United States. Now, on today's program, I want to show you that fiat currencies have not been successful, and the only aspect of fiat currencies that have stood the test of time is the inability of political systems to prevent the devaluation and debasement of this paper currency by letting the printing presses run wild. Now, that's common sense. You can't trade newly created paper, or today you might say you can't create digital money with no backing. And you can't trade that newly created currency for tangible stuff forever. At a certain point, people are going to wake up and say, wait a minute, this isn't backed by anything. And confidence in the currency is lost. And that has happened historically time and time and time again. In the fourth segment of today's program, I'm going to talk to you about the Roman Empire. I'm going to talk to you about fiat money in China called flying money. I'll talk to you about currency and fiat money failures in France and in Germany and a number of different places and Zimbabwe last decade. I mean, the pattern is always the same. So what I want to do today is give you an opportunity to get an additional resource if you'd like. We talk about this every week in our newsletter, which is titled Portfolio Watch. If you would like to get a free subscription to the Portfolio Watch newsletter, just go to the website, yourretirementoutlook.com. Your, retirementoutlook.com. Enter your name and your email address, and we'll be glad to get you a free subscription. We'll be back with Mr. Neil Howe after these words. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen, and I have the distinct pleasure of chatting once again today with returning guest, Mr. David Skorica. David is the founder and editor of the newsletter Addicted to Profits. His website is addictedtoprofits.net if you'd like to check it out. David, you know, when we talk about the market and you think about what the central bank's policy has been, the Fed has created a lot of new cash. And I've always said when you create money, when you create currency, it will find a home. So my question for you is this: to what extent has Fed policy really created maybe an artificial bull market or extended the bull market, in your opinion?
Oh, yeah, I definitely believe it has. I look at like past historical patterns and the like, and what I always thought, I was actually bullish. I'm not a perma bear. I was very bullish at the 2009, 2008 bottom. Actually, I hosted a conference in the Bahamas where I lived at the time, and I remember all the speakers on stage, and this is actually in March of 2009, a few weeks after the market made its low. I was the only, basically the only one saying that I think we could rally for 1 to 2, even 3 years in the market at that time. But I think what essentially happened is, my opinion is, the market should have probably topped out historically in the 2012-2013 period. But by doing the last QE of $85 billion a month all throughout 2013, they essentially juiced the equity markets. You know, we saw another bubble in sectors like biotechs and 3D printing and internet security, and bubbles in these kind of interest rate related stocks, in my opinion, like tobacco stocks and REITs, because people are searching for yield. So I believe that, yeah, the Fed essentially pushed everyone out of the government bond market, artificially deflated rates on bonds, and then this pushed people into other sectors. And, you know, you go look at an income fund, because you can't buy bonds because the Fed is buying them instead, you might have to buy a AAA-rated corporation or even a junk bond. And that essentially then creates the demand in these assets, and then creates an artificial kind of bull market in them. So yeah, I really believe that this should have been maybe a 3 to 4 year bull market, but end up has now been a 6+ year bull market because of the Fed's action. If you go look at one of the similar times in history, was probably the 1932 to 1937 period, when you had a financial crisis. Well, we didn't get an all out and out depression this time. We got a very severe recession, probably the most severe recession since the 30s. And again, the Fed cut rates to zero. Roosevelt came in and had New Deal programs. So the government stimulated, the Fed was stimulating. And that created this kind of 5-year bull market. And then when they kind of took the punch bowl away in 1937, and I'm going to equate this to what's going on now at the moment, all they did was raise the Fed funds rates like once or twice to about 0.5%. And then the market fell apart and fell 50%. And if I look what's going on today, we look at this 5 to 6 year bull market, similar like 32 to 37. And we're looking at the Fed maybe raising rates sometime in December, early next year. And what's interesting, in 37, there was about a 13% correction in the spring. And then the market rallied to within 2% of its high in August, and then completely fell apart. The Fed raised rates in September. So I look at what the action now is, that the Fed, the market peaked in May, slowly moved down, and then busted in August. This the rally of the fall got the market within 1% or 2% of its high, with most stocks not participating, and maybe we're setting up for like a period here of deja vu. And another part of the real dangerous thing of what the Fed did, and this is the unintended consequences of this loose monetary policy, is there has been nearly $9 trillion of debt of all sorts, energy debt, emerging market debt, municipal debt, U.S. government debt, corporate debt, created since 2009, okay, and in U.S. dollar terms. And a lot of this was created on the premise that, oh, the Fed is easing, that's bearish for the dollars, we could issue U.S. dollar debt to places like Turkey and Brazil or inefficient fracking and energy companies. And when they raise rates, the prices of all that debt are going to go up, and the double whammy for emerging markets is their currencies to continue to go down, and they may not be able to fund this U.S. dollar-denominated debt. It doesn't matter that the coupon or the interest on it is low, because if your currency falls 50% against the U.S. dollar, you probably can't pay back that bond if you're maybe a corporation in Turkey or Brazil. So this could trigger, in my opinion, a big, big debt crisis, and then you have this risk-on trade where people were short the U.S. dollar and long all these other assets. So then you see this rally in the dollar, and then it all feeds upon itself. So this rally in the dollar is really not because of, oh, the U.S. is stronger than everywhere else. No, this rally in the dollar is more because you have this huge trade where people are short dollars and we're long all these risk assets like you know, emerging market bonds denominated in dollars. And now they have to reverse those trades, and that could become a trading frenzy. And, of course, that would go to other parts of the bond market and equity markets, et cetera. And, by the way, the equity market, too, because of the handful of stocks keeping the indices high, is hiding the fact that the high-yield bond market is beginning to roll over. There's a lot of stress starting to show up in certain markets. But, again, this equity market being high is creating a false sense of complacency. And again, this is exactly what happened back in 2007. In 2007, when that market rallied and the Dow made a new high in October, everyone thought, oh, you know, the Fed's cutting, subprime's contained, it's fine. And I think this is the same thing that is going on today.
So, David, what is in your ultimate forecast for stocks? And we'll use the metric, the S&P 500 and the Dow Jones Industrial Average. Do you have an ultimate prediction?
See, what I'm trying to do is actually, I'll give you my approximation. I'm trying to kind of get away from that. I actually recently did a podcast saying is I don't like these forecasters that say they have a computer model and they can predict exactly where the market's going. It's kind of charlatans, in my opinion. So, but what I would like I need to do is just find these flawed companies. Right now, stocks as a percentage of GDP historically trade at about 65% of GDP. So they trade about two-thirds the size of the economy. Right now, they're at almost 130%. So they're essentially twice their historical median. The only other time they hit this, by the way, was for a few months in 2000. In 2000, the market fell. So I don't think there's any reason why, if this gets out of its control, like 1937-38, or like 2000-2002, the market cannot fall 40 to 50% again, especially with this historical norms of valuation and the whatnot. So, yeah, I would say, you know, I don't know where the S&P will peak. Maybe we'll have another surge of 2,200. I think it's topping in here. But, yeah, if the S&P went back to 1,000 to 1,200, ultimately in the next few years, that would not surprise me.
Okay, let me ask in the time we have left, David, in light of all the easy money policies that the Fed has actually been engaging in, do you have a take on where gold may go from here? Gold's arguably been a bit beat down here over the past few years.
Yeah, it's actually the gold bear market in terms of actual time is really quite remarkable. It is now almost a 4.5-year bear market. The only bear market I could find comparable was about 1996 to 2001 when gold, and even gold technically bottomed in 99. In 2001, you just retested that low. But it was essentially about a 4-year bear market in the stocks, about a 4.5-year bear market in the metal. So I would think that gold could maybe head down to about 10,030 to 10,050, maybe go down to 1,000. Again, I don't know. It's always difficult to time these things exactly. But I would think that due to the extreme negative sentiment and the length of the bear market, we're definitely closer to the end. Like we're in the ninth inning. Be it at the top of the ninth or the end of the ninth. So, and also, I think that a lot of gold is priced in the Fed doing these rate hikes and increasing the value of the U.S. dollar. And my opinion is that they will be able to do one, maybe two rate hikes before these things in emerging markets and these other things I'm talking about happen. And then when that blows up, actually, we'll be looking at them taking back those rate hikes and probably doing another QE. And that is when gold will reverse. Again, it's tough to know, but I would think something like that probably will happen in the next 12 to 18 months. But just from a fundamental standpoint, these gold stocks are down 80 plus percent from their highs. The gold stocks compared to gold, compared to the price of gold, compared to the S&P 500 are at all-time lows. So you're basically buying these companies at all-time lows valuations compared to the underlying price of gold and compared to equities as a whole. So this is what John Templeton would call maximum pessimism. This is probably the time to be like averaging in. If, say, in some kind of plan, you could just buy a little bit of a gold mutual fund or gold ETF every month, that would probably be a prudent strategy for the next 12 to 24 months.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there, David. It's been a pleasure having you on the program. And if someone wants to learn more about your work, what would you have them do?
Yeah, go to addictedtoprofits.net. I have a complimentary newsletter where we send out updates, kind of informing people on how we trade. Once every month or two, I do a special offer to the newsletter. If you like what you see, you could sign up to that.
All right. Well, again, thank you for being on the program. Everything Financial Radio returns after these words. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen, and thanks again to author Neil Howe for joining us on today's program. You know, on today's program, I have been talking about Winston Churchill's quote. Mr. Churchill said, "The best way to see into the future is to study the past," and we're focusing today on fiat currencies. In a prior segment, I talked about the fact that we have concluded that money and currency cycles exist, and in essence, money and currency evolve. Money or currency changes over time. We have currency and money being the same thing when the money and currency have tangible or intrinsic value. So a good example of that I gave in the last segment is that a quarter, half dollar, or dollar that was minted in the United States pre-1965 had actual tangible or intrinsic value. During that same time frame, there was something called a silver certificate. It was a paper certificate or a paper receipt that one could exchange for the real money, the coins with intrinsic tangible value. And then as time goes on and politicians and policymakers tend to overspend, currencies become a fiat currency. These currencies don't have any tangible or intrinsic value. Common sense tells you you can't have newly printed money, newly created money, money created out of thin air, traded for tangible stuff over the long term. So we're really not debating the what is going to happen here historically. What we're debating is the when. Now I'll give you just a few quick examples in this segment. And I'll start with an example from more than 2,000 years ago. It was the Roman Empire. And although Rome didn't actually have paper money, it provided one of the first examples of true debasement of currency. The denarius, which was Rome's currency of the time, was pure silver at the beginning of the first century. By about 50 AD, an emperor by the name of Nero entered the scene, and the denarius was reduced to about 94% silver. 50 years later, the silver content of the denarius was down to 85%. 100 years later, it was down to 43%. Just 30 years after that, it was down to 0.05%. At the time of Rome's collapse, the denarius contained only 0.02% silver, and nobody at the time accepted it as an acceptable store of value. So one thing you see when fiat currencies are debased, the one thing we can learn from studying the Roman Empire is that the debasement starts gradually at first, but like the proverbial slippery slope, the debasement accelerates over time. One sees the same thing when you study China. When the Chinese first started using paper money, they called it flying money because it could just fly from your hands. The reason for the issuance of paper money or paper currency, more properly stated, is simple. And in China, there was a copper shortage, so banks had switched to the use of iron coinage. These iron coins became overissued and they fell in value. That's what happens when currencies are debased or currency is printed. It falls in value. In the 11th century, a bank in the Sichuan province of China issued paper money in exchange for the iron coins. Initially, this was fine because the paper currency was exchangeable for gold, silver, or silk. However, because a lot of this paper currency was printed, inflation began to take hold. Eventually, the flying money in China also failed. Now, we can talk about the French. The French have been particularly unsuccessful in their attempts with fiat money or fiat currency. John Law was the first man to issue paper currency to France. In fact, in my book, New Retirement Rules, I talk about this in detail. The notion of paper currency was greatly helped along by the fact that Louis XIV left France with a lot of debt. Louis XV took over. However, Louis XV was 7 years old when he assumed the throne. So the regent and John Law got together and started to print paper currency to help pay down the debt that Louis the 14th left. Well, Louis the 15th grew up and was eventually old enough to make his own mistakes, so he required that all taxes be paid in paper currency. Now, at this time, the paper currency was still backed by coinage. And then, as almost always happens, confidence was lost in the currency, and people decided to show up and take the coins instead of the paper currency. This actually happened in the United States in the late 60s and early 70s, and in 1971, as a result of foreign investors wanting to exchange their paper U.S. dollars, their paper U.S. currency for gold, President Richard Nixon closed the gold window in 1971, stating he was going to temporarily suspend the redemptions of the paper U.S. dollars, the paper U.S. currency for gold. And obviously, we all know those suspensions have stayed in place. Those redemptions have never resumed. Law did the same thing. He just made it illegal to own the coins and said you have to use paper currency. France, again, in the latter part of the 18th century, tried to use paper currency. This time, the paper currency was called the assignat. By 1795, inflation was running at about 13,000%. Why? Because the politicians of the day simply printed too many assignats. Napoleon then took over and brought with him the gold franc, and you see another example of this currency money cycle. We could talk about Weimar Germany. We could talk about Argentina. We could talk about the Russian ruble. We could talk about Zimbabwe last decade. The bottom line is the outcome is always the same. Fiat currencies ultimately fail. Now, again, predicting the when is a lot more difficult than predicting the what. If you look back at the United States history, which, and again, in the book New Retirement Rules, we do that. In the newsletter every week, Portfolio Watch, we touch on this. There are a number of times historically that this has happened in the United States as well. Now, if you're not yet a subscriber to the Portfolio Watch newsletter, I'd like to extend an invitation for you to subscribe. It's easy. All you have to do is go to the website, yourretirementoutlook.com. That's Y-O-U-R, yourretirementoutlook.com. Just enter your name and email address, and we'll be glad to put you on the list. Every week, every Monday, you'll get that current week's issue of the Portfolio Watch newsletter. And if you'd like to listen to any of the interviews that we have with our guest experts at any time, all you have to do is go to the iTunes store, search under Everything Financial Radio, and you can get a free subscription, a free feed to get the radio program in the form of a podcast whenever it is released, which is weekly. So again, you can go to the iTunes store or you can go to the website, Everything Financial Radio, everythingfinancialradio.com, and the interviews are posted there as well. Next week on the program, I'll be talking to Mr. David Skorica, newsletter editor, and the newsletter is Addicted to Profits, and get his take on where U.S. stocks are headed. He has some very interesting predictions. You won't want to miss it. That's our program for this week. Hope you got something you can use. Bye.